Hello and welcome to Naxos Classical Spotlight and music by English composer Sir Malcolm Arnold. You just heard the beginning of one of his English dances. Arnold is perhaps best known for these sets of dances plus more than 100 film scores, but is much less well known for his excellent symphonies. My guest in this podcast is Andrew Penny, who conducted all these symphonies and dances for Naxos with either the Ireland National Symphony Orchestra or the Queensland Symphony Orchestra. Here is the very beginning of Symphony No. 1. Andrew, how did you first discover the music of Malcolm Arnold? Where was it?
Well, I think it was as a young clarinet player playing in what I think you might call a community orchestra or youth orchestra, because the wonderful dances came up quite often. And then for a wind player, we all want to try the sea shanties. So I think it was probably through those initial contact with playing them on those wonderful Patterson parts, you know, which you can identify Malcolm Arnold's own hand in the manuscript writing. So then I think it would be probably the Fifth Symphony. I remember the last night of the proms, there was a piece that he wrote for audience and orchestra. So he was around, you know, and I wouldn't say I knew the symphonies before I was given the task of recording them, though. I probably just knew number 2 and number 5. You know how some composers are very difficult to make your orchestra sound good? If you think of the very high string writing of Nielsen or some of Britain's tricky orchestration. But if you play a Malcolm Arnold dance or a Malcolm Arnold symphony, your band or your orchestra sound fantastic. He writes so that young players and amateur players, as well as testing professionals, but your group can make a great sound. And I think that's a great gift, don't you?
What does he do to make that possible?
I think it's an insight and knowledge of the instruments. And I've got another idea for you. You remember that he was a trumpeter sitting at the back of the orchestra counting lots of bars rest. Do you not think when, after the Second World War, when they were playing more Mahler than the generation before had heard, when they were playing Sibelius symphonies, when they were playing Berlioz, do you not think in the bars rest he would look around and think, gosh, how does that work? Why isn't that working? What a great sound that is. And I'm sure that his sound comes from the trumpeter's ear when he's not playing. He would be fascinated by why an ensemble, why a corner wasn't working, or how a chord worked, or the possibilities of the instruments, or what put them in extremis. And I think that's why he's a player's composer.
You probably came to the dances before the symphonies, but what surprises you most about his music, but especially the symphonies? When I got to them, I felt like I'd wandered into a completely different world.
Well, it is a completely different world. Put yourself at the time when he started off and was writing the dances, which are by and large cheerful, optimistic, fun. He was well known for writing film scores. He wrote over 100 film scores, and he was very well off. There are legion tales about him tipping waiters and waitresses 150 quid, you know, when he'd been paid for a film. But the symphonies he wrote perhaps for a different audience, or you might say for himself, because when the symphonies came out, he didn't have at the time great critical acclaim. In fact, some critics rather went for him, because they associated this music with the mind of someone writing lighter music or film music, and that was rather snobby and snooty, we now realise. And the symphonies tell a very different story, and I wonder if the phrase sad-faced clown might be appropriate, in that there's much more depth. There is Sibelius, there is Berlioz, there are Mahlerian funeral marches, which of course he doesn't touch on in film music because there isn't the time for that development. So I think it's a fascinating comparison between the lighter stuff, the film stuff, and the symphonic output. And if I could just perhaps develop that. When I did the symphonic cycle, I thought I would be doing 1 and 2, 3 and 4, 5 and 6, you know, ending up with number 9. But Naxos knew that 9 had never been recorded. There was a recording Sir Charles Gross did with the BBC, which was never commercially released. So I'd done 1 and 2, and then I jumped to number 9. This was to enable Naxos to have a premiere recording out there. And I was sort of slightly against that because I wanted to live the cycle and grow the cycle chronologically, you might say. So very quickly, I was submerged in the trauma of the end of the cycle, which could have been a good thing because you then bring back to 3 and 4 and 5 and 6, 7 and 8, knowing how the story ends, you know. And so in the end, I don't regret being made to do that jump. I think it worked out fine.
The Ninth Symphony really is a very different world. And I, you know, I've read it was also a very different world for Malcolm Arnold.
Yes, it was. He'd come back from what he described as a journey through hell. He'd had a complete breakdown. And in fact, the Eighth Symphony could well have been the last thing he wrote, had it not been for John Anthony Day, Alan Poulton, people like that who rescued him. And he then had another 20 years of life and did manage to write the Ninth Symphony to a commission from BBC North of England for 1985, the European Music Year. But on sight of the score, David Ellis, who'd commissioned it, and Edward Downes, the conductor, who I studied with actually, rejected it because it just looked so different. This was not, as you just pointed out, this was not the world of the dances or of the jocular film music. It's really in two parts. And that's a pun because there's a lot of two-part writing in it. But if you think of the first three movements as the first half, and then this large farewell, which is the last movement, and that is really 2 o'clock in the morning in a darkened room with a glass of something Scottish to listen to, you know?
To me, it's a very, very profound, very deep work and a very, very personal piece of music.
It is, and yet it ends on a major chord. Is there a note of optimism there? But the journey to get there is a tough one. And not to push the point, but on that disc, which by the time we'd recorded, it was a little under the length for a CD, I said, why don't I record an interview with Sir Malcolm and we'll interlace it with extracts from the symphony. It would make a nice completion to the disc rather than put another piece with it, which might have been terribly out of place, I think. So we did this interview and I would like to say we ran it past a decent libel lawyer, but you know what I mean? It was, there were bits we had to cut out. But I think the interview is quite powerful because don't forget, he had attended every session of every symphony over the, 5 years that we recorded. He came across to Ireland and there was just one session when he was taken slightly ill and had to go back to the hotel, but he was in the hall for every note that you hear on that those discs.
Really?
Oh yes, he and John Anthony Day were there, and I would go up to them at the tea breaks and the lunch breaks and ask for his comments on what he'd just heard. And at no stage, Raymond, did he ever say, well, that doesn't work, or that should be done again. or I don't like the way you link that movement to that movement. He was always very encouraging. And so although there are differences between my performances and Hickok's and Handley, he felt that the music could take it. So he didn't mind different views on it, which of course is the hallmark of great music. It can take different interpretations. And I'm pretty sure he attended some of the sessions of other people's recordings. And I bet they've got similar stories, that he was not interventionist in that way.
For people who are listening to this podcast and are, you know, hopefully going to start exploring his music, yeah, are there particular examples or pieces you wanted to introduce a bit to help them on that quest?
Well, the Second Symphony is very interesting for its echoes of other composers and for this very, very strong slow movement of the Funeral March. The Fifth Symphony is quite a good one to start with. Once you've got through the first movement, which is a tribute in music to four people who died, so Frederick Thurston, the clarinet player, Dennis Brain, the horn player, Gerard Hoffnung, who he'd worked with on those rather fun concerts, who was a tuba player, and a dancer called David Paltenghi. So that first movement has prominent lines for clarinet, horn, tuba. Then the rest of the Fifth Symphony is extraordinary. It's the most beautiful, beautiful slow movement tune on the strings, which again is quite Mahlerian, which he brings back at the end. But not, it sort of sounds like it's going to be a big film music ending, but he tricks you. and the ending isn't big and triumphal like a Shostakovich. It fades away and it leaves you with a big question mark. And then for me, we've talked about the ninth a bit, but for me, one of the greatest English symphonies is the seventh, Arnold's Seventh Symphony, in which he has musical portraits of his three children, Catherine, Robert, and Edward. Now, Edward was autistic, and they left Cornwall to go to Ireland, where there was help in the early knowledge of what autism was. And the last movement, which has, he's very fond affection for the Chieftains, which is the Irish folk music group. So those are the three portraits. But over all of that is the use of the cowbell. He wants one cowbell in the first movement and thereafter two differently tuned cowbells. And it's a cataclysmic effect. I think it has to be that way around. The great big, the biggest bell you can get. I have heard it done with a much smaller handheld thing. It does sound rather like the call to dinner at Downton Abbey. We hired a couple of enormous bells from percussion services, and they came and we had to put them on this wooden rack. Well, I can see myself now, we recorded this thing, and the guy, the only way he could hit it was with his back to me, and he belted these things and they were swinging forwards and backwards. I thought, crikey, if that lot comes down, that'll be a good outtake. For me, one of the joys about doing the symphonic recording was that when I was a student and had finished my clarinet studies, I'd done some conducting at the college. I'd put on things myself, which is how a young conductor gets known. And you usually had to do 20th century stuff because nobody's going to say, oh, I've just heard of this fella in the second year. He's absolutely marvellous. Give him Brahms 4. It's not going to happen. When they started the conducting course, and I was the first one on it. There were two of us. The tutor was Sir Charles Groves, who I'd always loved his conducting and was very well aware of his career, so it was an absolute delight to be mixing with him. Then I went on courses with Edward Downes in Holland, and I got very close to him and his way of working. He worked regularly with the BBC Philharmonic in Manchester, so I was able to go to lots of rehearsals in Manchester, lots of rehearsals in Liverpool with Charles. And these were two very, very important men. Now, Charles Groves it was who commissioned the second symphony for Bournemouth of Arnold. He fought for the Ninth Symphony to exist and conducted a performance with a student orchestra, and then this BBC Philharmonic recording. Ted Downes, again with the BBC Philharmonic, had been involved in a marvellous festival which just featured the music of Haydn and Arnold. And there is a tape of Ted doing the Seventh Symphony, which, you know, if it was released commercially, would see the rest of us off, I think. Wonderful performance. He took sight of the score of the Ninth Symphony and vetoed it. He was roughly a contemporary of Arnold at the Royal College of Music, because Downes was a horn player and Arnold was a trumpeter, so they did overlap at college. And so here were these two great men that I was working with at different times, not on the music of Arnold, but Groves and Downes, who were linked amazingly strongly with the Arnold story, and I got the chance to record a cycle of the Arnold symphonies. And I felt that that was meant to be, and I was very pleased to have that completion of the circle, and that the whole cycle, whilst it doesn't model itself on any of their performances, is inextricably linked with those two rather important English conductors.
You have been listening to music by Malcolm Arnold and an interview with Andrew Penny, who conducted all of Arnold's dances and symphonies for Naxos, with either the Ireland National Symphony Orchestra or the Queensland Symphony Orchestra. All of this available in one box set, Naxos catalog number 8.506041. With beautiful playing, and it's a wonderful way to discover the symphonies that are woefully underperformed by many orchestras. I'm Raymond Bechet. Thanks for joining me. To go out, here is the very ending of Malcolm Arnold's Symphony No. 7 with his musical tip of the hat to the chieftains.